Okay, welcome back, everybody. So we have three items that we're going to be following through this evening. We're going to be learning about three very important aspects of the Beis HaMikdash. I also want to mention that we're going to be learning this evening for the Refuah Shlema of Sarah Leah Bas Brindle, God willing. We'll be undergoing a procedure tomorrow, and Mr. Shem should be a successful one. We are going to be covering three different topics today. So if you have not had a chance to be up to date, that's fine too, because these will stand in their own space. Number one, we are going to be focusing on the idea of we're going to meet Yachin and Boaz. If you don't know who they are, that's fine. We're going to meet them in a second. Number two, we're going to meet the Yam Shel Shlomo. We've heard that name. We've heard the concept. Let's try to expand upon that. And number three, we're going to meet the Mechonot. We're going to meet the wagons. Three items that are going to be our topic for tonight. And they're pretty unusual in the sense that we don't see them in the Mishkan. We don't meet these ideas in the Mishkan whatsoever. These are unique to the Beis HaMikdash. Also want to acknowledge, it was actually very fortuitous. The Zidders who came to the Shir just a few weeks ago, so Kenny was in Yerushalayim, he actually bought this Sefer called Otzer HaBayis HaRishon from the Mechon HaMikdash. The Mechaber, the author is HaRav Menachem Mekubar. It's excellent. And so not only does it have a lot of fantastic sources as a resource, but it also has a number of pictures, which are going to be very helpful for us to try to get a sense of the understanding. Of course, it's all illustrations, but it's very useful in trying to understand this. So with that in mind, let's try to understand these sections. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to start, we're in Perek Zayin, so if we're in the text packets over here of our, which is the one that says Making the Mikdash on the front, we are actually going to be starting from Pasuk Tes Zayin, Tes Vav, which is essentially the top Pasuk on page 7. So we're at the top of that page, and we're going to really read through that to Pasuk Chof Beis. Essentially, we're going to bracket off the first half of the page. This is the section of Yachin and Boaz. So let's read it, try to absorb what's going on over here, and then get a sense of perspective. So let's start off at the beginning. We're told the following. Vayotzer es shnei ha'amudim nechoshes. And he made two pillars of brass. Who is the he, folks? Who is the pronoun? Just quickly before we go further. Who is making this? His name is Hiram. Hiram was the architect who was sent from Tyre, not the king. He was the architect sent from Tyre, and he had interesting background. We saw that he came from the tribe of Dan and Naphtali, depending on the version of Dirayomim versus Melachim. He's sent down, and he is a coppersmith. Why is he a coppersmith? Because his father was a coppersmith, which is why you're going to see that all the following implements which are talked about are in fact brass implements, which is why he's mentioned and inserted here. So here's one of his first contributions. So it says he made these pillars, Shmona Esrei Amma, Koma Samuda Echad, each there were 18 amas tall, V'chut Shtem Esrei Amma, Yosoy V'Samuda Hasheni. And there was a line of 12 cubits around the one of them. Ushtei kotarot osot, and they each had these, they call them capitals here, but another way, kotarot is like a keter, so like a crown of sorts. Laseis al roshei ha'amudim, mutzak nechoshech, they were made of brass. Chamesh amos komas ha'koteres ha'echad, v'chamesh amos komas ha'koteres ha'shenis. And these are large crowns. So we're talking about a crown which is essentially the height of more than a person, essentially. There was this netted work, this checker work underneath them, gedilim, which were maaseh shar sheros. They were this braided chain work like kotarot, asher rosh amudim, shiva la koteres echad v'shiva la koteres hasheni. There were seven braids on one crown and seven braids on the other. So you can imagine these large towering pillars, and if we can imagine just for a moment. If a cubit is roughly 2 feet long, Esther, just so the packets are not just over here. If a cubit is roughly 2 feet long, so 18 amos is roughly 36 feet. So we're talking about a pretty substantial pillar, and they had pillars on either side with these very large crowns upon them. Vayas es ha'amudim u'shtei turim tsoviv ala shvachol ha'echas. And there were two rows on each of these networks or this framework. And there were these rows of brass which went up covering the netting work, which was covered with rimonim. They had pomegranates hanging, these decorative brass pomegranates hanging. V'kotarosa shel rosha amudim ma'aseh shushan ba'olam, that were, the way they describe it here, were lily work. Arba amos, there was another sort of engraving pattern of lilies, of flowers along them. V'kotaros al shnei ha'amudim gamimalu umi'elu umas ha'beten asher le'eved ha'sevacha v'arimonim mosayim turim saviv al ha'koteres ha'shenis. So it talks about the area where it was a belly, which is, so to speak, the mid-frame of the crown, was hanging these 200 pomegranates, and this is a debate between the Meforshim, whether this crown on lattice work was above the pillar or was subsumed into the 18 amos of the pillar itself. And he established them by the ulam. The ulam we saw was that the temple was divided into three stations. There was the dvir, the innermost chamber, that's the Kodesh HaKadoshim. There was the Heichal, which was where the Kodesh was, where all the major implements were. And there was the Ulam. The Ulam was, in a certain sense, the antechamber. In front of the antechamber was where these pillars stood. Vayokem es ha'amud ha'yemani va'yikra shmo Yachin. Vayokem es ha'amud ha'shmo smoli va'yikra shmo Boaz. And he called them names. So he called them Yachin and Boaz. He called them actually names. Val rosh ha'amudim ma'aseh shoshan. And on each of them was this lily work, this flower pattern, Vatitoma Meleches Amudim, and it was completed. So this is just worthwhile noting. So these pillars, were they supporting anything? And the answer is no. They were completely decorative. As opposed to, so just to make a notation, you can see this is a very easy way to notice the difference between the first and the second Beis HaMikdash. When you look at the second Beis HaMikdash, which is actually the cover picture of these booklets, of the text booklets, you'll notice this is actually a picture of the second Beis HaMikdash. One of the easy ways to know that is not only because of the elaborate design, but you notice that the pillars reach all the way up to the ceiling. Do you see that? The pillars reach all the way to the ceiling. Whenever we see a picture of the Beis HaMikdash, we're usually looking at the second Beis HaMikdash. The first Beis HaMikdash is the one in which can be found on the cover of, let me see which packet we're working on. We're working with 3.4 today. And so you'll look at that one, you'll see that those pillars are purely decorative. Let me just catch up a copy for myself. These pillars, as you can sort of see, really reach into the air and are, in a certain sense, the accompaniment as you enter the Beis HaMikdash. Very different kind of picture. There is a debate as to the height of the ulam. Some versions, you'll notice, by the way, it's pretty short. The pillars reach around the height. Many versions, like the version on the cover of this book as an example, the ulam is much higher. So it's a very, very, very steep antechamber, but in front of it are these two decorative pillars, the Yachin and Boaz. Just worthwhile in terms of understanding the perspective over here. Very strange. What we're not going to get into here over here is the debate between the Mepharshim of where those kotaros worked, how did the lattice work, the lily work, the pomegranates, and all the patterns interchange with each other. There's a lot of different arguments as to how those interplayed with each other. I'm going to focus less on that this evening. I think the more important thing to focus on right now is the ideology. What did he mean by this? Besides what being a beautiful decoration, and also then, you know, they obviously were so important to Shlomo HaMelech that he even called them names. So that is a very unusual thing. Just out of interest, does anybody know of any sefer called Yachin and Boaz by any chance? Nice. Right over here. So let me just get it to show you where they appear. Okay. If we take out any Mishnayos, the regular Mishnayos over here, so this is the Shishar Sidri Mishnah we found in any base medrash. If you open it up, first of all, you'll notice, by the way, that in a lot of Sha'arim in a Sefer, they'll often have two pillars, that is four pillars. But a lot of them are actually patterned after the Yachin and Boaz. But on any page of a Mishnayos, you'll find the bottom of every Mishnayos, regular Mishnayos, is printed the Tiferes Yisrael. Rav Yisrael Lipschitz, who lived in Germany. And what's interesting is that he has two explanations. One's called Yachin and one is called Boaz. He calls the Yachin the more sort of straightforward stuff, and the more complex issues, he puts in what he calls his commentary, the Boaz. And they're both two sets of footnotes to the Mishnayos. He patented off this just as a fascinating historical footnote as to this. Now, let's try to delve into what is going on over here. Why was Shlomo doing this? What was he trying to achieve? So there's a number of different levels we can try to invest ourselves in. One level we can look at is what the Radak says, Rav David Kimchi, about in the medieval times. So he said it's a very interesting thing. Let's take a look at this. This is in source 59, which is on page 21. We're in packet now 3.4 because we're finishing up last week first. And what he says is the following: Yachin, what's Yachin? Mashikora Shem La'amudim L'Siman Tov is a good sign. It's a sign of goodness. What does the word yachin come from? Prepare. You're about to enter into the sanctuary. Prepare yourself. And also that the house itself should be prepared. What was the name Boaz? It's about an expression of strength. V'hi mila murkeves, boy oz, in it is strength. Kelomar, shi'itan akel boy oz, v'kiyum komoi shenemar Hashem oz la'amoy. Hashem is strong to his nation. So essentially, what was this metaphor doing, according to the Radak? Whose words are they representing and reflecting in actuality, a tangible expression of a word? It's almost like the concrete form of a wish. Whose words are they? They are the concrete expression of Shlomo's own words. What he's saying is as he builds this bias, he says, Yachin, let the house be established, Uva'az, and there is strength in it. So it's almost like he's, blessings are worth wonderful things, and it's wonderful when people call you up for good tidings. But you know that time when somebody sends you a handwritten note? You know, when I had the opportunity of starting the rabbinate in the shul, somebody wrote a note to me with an acronym of my name. In Hebrew, it was so meaningful. I keep it on my desk, because that person, they so to speak, concretized their blessing. It wasn't just words. Shlomo Melech is saying, as he concretizes the Beis HaMikdash, he's investing in it the actual concrete form of his bracha, which is let this house be established and let there be strength in it. It's his tefillah in the most concrete sense. Fascinating. That's where the Radak looks at it. Brilliant. Let's drive it further. It could also be that we're referring to actual people as an example. So there's a number of different ways of looking at this. The Ralbag, from a more rationalistic perspective, he says that this could be referring to time demarcation. So let's see how he unfills this in source 60. He says Vayakim es amudim l'ulam ha'ichal rotze lomar shekiman bo v'loy hayu na'asim. So the southernmost one is called Yachin, the northernly one is called Boaz, because which direction are you facing when you look at the door of the Beis HaMikdash? You're looking west. The westmost area is where the Devir, where the Kodesh Kodoshim is. So if I'm looking west, right to my right is the south, and to my right. Is south, yes, and to my left is my north. And so therefore he says, Ki'ilu he'ir boze al sod gadol me'akivun. He is hinting in this constellation something about the ideas of direction. Me'inyan kli beis ha'migdash, k'moy she'bi'arnu minyanim b'sefer, ve'elu shemois v'u yadua ki Hashem yisporach som bateva batukufois ha'arba Roshem lahavayos hashiflus vatakufois hashtayim. Hashemesh bohem dromi, hei mechinos hahavayos tukusa nisharos yateva chazak. Vooz lasos pulosop. So he says one dimension of reality is under the jurisdiction of the sun, and that's expressed in the direction of south. Vzemavuar niglebets mochim. So whatever this means, I'm not sure exactly what this means on a biological level, is the kingdom of flora is able to benefit more from the domain under the sun than the animals. When I get to the end of this essay, so what he says is that there's two different dimensions, and if you think about it, it's the two different dimensions of time, and each dimension of time relates to a different kingdom. The kingdom of flora, the kingdom of fauna, and both of these are expressed in this place, which is ultimately the place of resonance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A little hard to understand also what the science that he's working with. Is he talking metaphysically or is he talking physically? The Ralbag generally is not a Kabbalist at all. So we can assume that he was talking philosophically and rationalistically, but it's hard to know exactly what he means. But there's a deeper concept here. Dina, what do you think?
Doesn't bother anybody that those stone pillars, beautifully made, are
In which way? In which respect?
The way that, you know, at this time, people were worshipping all kinds of other gods. Those gods had names, whether it was a tree or made out of stone. All of a sudden, in front of the Mikdash,
that's a very good question.
You have
That's a very good question.
Other examples in the Tanakh that stone was named?
Yeah, but they were called off the person who donated them.
Maybe this was named the person that named it too.
Yeah, you know, in the second Beis Hamikdash, we have Shari Nikanor. But it's interesting, we don't really have this. Adina, if I could hold your question, I'll tell you why. Because in the next two segments tonight, we're going to come across what I felt were actually more disturbing implements. Okay, so I actually never thought about the question from the perspective of you raising it, in terms of, so to speak, the deification possibility over here. And certainly the way the Radak is saying is that this is a channeling of tefillah in a concrete sense. So, but you're right, it has the potential of being misappropriated, and we'll see some of that in just a moment. And when it comes to the Yamshel Shlomo and the Mechonos, and that's a little bit of more of a worry. Misinterpretation.
To the environment where he's living, and so I feel that something is slipping in.
I wouldn't put it that way. The way I would say it is the following. I would say that Shlomo HaMelech has the ability and the capacity to understand a lot of the meridians of power in this world that we don't have access to. So therefore, he is able to, in a certain sense, you know, channel that electricity and put it through this instruction. But we, as basic proletariats who look in on the outside, may make a mistake and misunderstand some of the things he is doing. That would be the way I would say it, rather than saying that Shlomo himself over here was influenced. Just to be very careful. Sure, but when you want to have a person who is channeling the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to be found in this world, you want to have somebody who gets it the most, and he does get it the most in this particular instance. So that's what he's doing. The question is, but people are fickle. That's the problem. Ira.
I sort of disagree. These were the only things that were named, but there's no evidence ever that a Jew or a non-Jew ever worshipped any of these things.
Correct.
It tells you the name, then perhaps designates something important. Today we put names on rocket ships, on boats, on airplanes, on anything and everything. Nobody worships them.
You're right. We are living in a different age. We're living in the time, the era in which Avodah Zorah, polytheism, is rampant.
And
your point is true, that the history has told us that this was not an issue. The late ones are. But it is interesting, but today is not a comparison in the sense that today the reason why people have names on it is because they donated it. That's the only reason why names appear on things. But in those days, there could be a misunderstanding. I just want to do one last perspective. There is an idea where the Chida goes into Kabbalistically David and Boaz as actual names of human beings, and there's been channeling who they were as examples, so to speak. You know, he's going through the channels of those two human beings. But it is interesting, just to understand this, the Malbim, generally speaking, is not a Kabbalist in terms of the way he explains Tanakh. The Malbim usually is very clear about words, word structure, bigger picture. Here, he goes into an incredible depth of Kabbalistic thought. Huge paragraph on this. We're going to do just a very, very skim the top of it just to see that there's much more than meets the eye when it comes to this Beis HaMikdash. We are not looking at simply an architectural structure. We're not looking at something that we would take a picture of and include in Seven Wonders of the World. It's much more than that. Here's the way the Malbim frames it. Very strange description here. Let's take a look at this source, which is in our packets here. This is Source 62, the last one of this page. And that is, he says, Shmona Esrei Amo, Koima Sa'amud Ha'echod, V'ramzu B'Koima, Ki Ha'yosod Moshech Mitiferes Yisrael, Tiferes Gufo, Shemerumez, B'Chai Chul Yos Shibashidra. He says, we are attributing to what is the notion of Tiferes. What is Tiferes, by the way? Tiferes is translated as beauty, but it's actually the third level of Spheres, right? It goes Chesed Gvura Tiferes. Right, so in the triangle, Chesed Gvura Tiferes. Tiferes is in the center. That relates to the central spine, which is, of course, 18 vertebrae long. Now, I actually happened to be speaking to a chiropractor earlier this week because it appears in brachos this week that one of the reasons why we have 18 brachos in the Shmona Esrei is because there are 18 chulios in the span. But the truth be told is that there's more. So it depends where you start measuring from. If you remove the neck vertebra, in fact there are, when you go down to the tail, but we're excluding at this point in time measuring the five in the neck. This is what he says, is that Kabbalistically it's referring to the 18 links in the central back. So he says, this 18 are a compilation of 12. 12 are the 12 permutations of the name Shem Havaya, which is the name Yud Hey and then Vav and Hey, with the 12 constellations of the different Nekudos switched round, which reflect the 12 Shvatim, which reflect the 12 months. If you ever read one of the old Siddurim, when you go through a Musaf on Rosh Chodesh, we just did Rosh Chodesh last week, you'll see at the bottom they'll have the actual vowelizations of the Shem Havaya in all 12 permutations, which relate to the 12 months. It's those plus the 6 points of direction, which means 4 directions and up and down, which is essentially the 3 axes X, Y, and Z, and positive and negative, right? So put those all together. You have 6 and the 12. That's the sum total of, we'll call it Kabbalistic incorporation. That's reflected in the 18, which is of course the Tiferes, the back. So just to point out, these are concepts which I'm just saying the words rather than explaining them because I don't have access to these. But at the same time, There's a pattern here which is bigger than us, and I want to just leave this point knowing that this is a much bigger idea. I do want to challenge people to think about where else we do see Yachin and Boaz in our lives. As an example, I put in the actual sources here on page 22 a picture of a really standard kapa, a paroiches on an Aron HaKodesh. In fact, you'll see it's got a number on it, which is 924, because that's design 924 when you're choosing them for whatever paroiches you want. Those pillars on the side there are an example of Yachin and Boaz. You probably don't... No, you wouldn't notice that. You just say, oh, well, that's just decorative. No, it is actually a reflection. You'll notice the crowns at the top of them, which are supporting the menorah. As an example, we'll see them in statues. We'll see them all over as the Yachin and Boaz. It's worthwhile noting them and trying to understand how, in a certain sense, ubiquitous they are in Jewish iconology, where they appear in our tradition. What we looked at were 3 different levels, where the Radak says it's a concretized form of tefillah, where we saw the Ralbag says it relates to different times, where it be the southern time or the northern time, dimensions in time relating to fauna and flora. The Chiddush said it actually reflects 2 people, David and Boaz, and the Malbim says that their height is also reflective of certain Kabbalistic principles, the flow of energy through the dimension of Tiferes. Fascinating. Obviously a lot to think about. I think this is important because it also means to say that when we get back to the rest of it and we see, you know, rooms and engravings, and we should also realize there's more to it, there's more import than simply what we see at the face value. Let's move into the next section here, which is a little more reachable. We can understand this a little more. There's some very, very fascinating things over here. And this is actually tonight's work. This is 3.5, the Seal of Shlomo. This is one of the most enigmatic parts of the Beis HaMikdash, which we've never seen before. Here we have it from Sukkim Chav Gimel to Chav Vav. We're back on page 7 in our actual text. And here's what it says. Vayas es hayam mutzak. He made a molten sea. A yam is a sea. So he made a sea. So this obviously has to do with some sort of water. Eser ba'amah misvasoi ad svasoi agol soviv. It was 10 amos from edge to edge. V'chamesh ba'amah komosen. It was 5 amos high. So this is a pretty large container of water. The kav shloshim ba'amo yosov ososo. If you were to measure the circumference of it, it would be 30 around. Upekaim mitachas lisoso osoviv, and there were these little knops or these little sort of sticking out, protruding elements below its rim. Sovivim osoy eser ba'amo makifin esayam soviv shnei chutim apekaim yitzukim biyitzuk osoy, and there was two different rows of these knobs or knops that would stick out. Or made al shnei asar bakar, and this entire basin would rest upon 12 cattle, shlosha ponim tzofona, shlosha ponim yoma, shlosha ponim negba, shlosha ponim mizracha. 3 cattle facing in each direction, north, south, east, and west. That's the 12 upon which this large basin called the yam would rest. All of them, all the backs of the cows were facing inwards. In other words, you could not see any of the tails of any of the cows because they were facing the inner section which was supporting this bowl. And the actual thickness of the basin was one tefach thick. And it was wrought like the brim of a cup, like a flower lily. And it held alpaim bas yachil. It held 2,000 baths. So it was a very, obviously, large container. There are a number of different renditions of it. I actually put in our in the top of just 3.5, the unit of the actual mafarshim. This is one rendition of it. You can see the bowl, this brass bowl resting upon the 12 cows. You'll notice three in each direction over here. You can see its height. It's really a large height. Fascinating perspective. And this is really, really interesting here. Now, what is really going on? So a few things to consider when understanding this is, first of all, functionally, what was the point of this yam exactly? What was the point? We know that in the Mishkan, we had something called a kior, which was the wash basin. And that was really primarily for washing the hands and feet of the Kohanim as they prepare for their service, for their avodah. But this seems a lot bigger than a kior, and also we're about to see the kiorim in just a moment. So it's clearly not the function of hand washing. What is it for? Well, for this we actually need to fast forward in Tanakh to the place where it is talked about, which is in Divrei Hayamim. Let me see if I put this into our notes. Did I? I think I may have left it out. Oh, what a pity. Okay, well the Mitzvah Samar. Let me see. Yeah, no, actually the Mitzudos himself actually relates to this. He quotes this pasuk. He says, "Vayas es hayam." Yeah, no. So I did quote later on. You're right. Thank you. The Mitzudos over here does explain it's the function of the yam right now. He says, we're on the new source packet 3.5, source 63. He says, "Vayas es hayam gigis gedola asuya kedmus yahayam." It was a large barrel, so to speak, which was like a sea because it was so large. It was used as a mikveh. So it was not for their hands or feet. It was actually the mikveh on premises. There's a problem with that because halachically speaking, we know that a mikveh cannot be drawn water, cannot be in a container. Actually, putting water into a container disqualifies the use of a mikveh, which is why if you've ever been around when a new mikveh has been consecrated in a community, you have to wait a few months because you have to wait for the real mikvehs to fill up, not the mikvehs that people go into. The mikvehs that people go into are not the mikvehs which are filled with the rainwater. The rainwater is actually hiding. So in a regular mikveh, if you ever want to see the back end, which is fascinating just how it works, when you go into a mikveh, you're walking into the wonderful, warm, chlorinated mikveh. That's the we'll call it the consumer end, right? The other end of the mikveh is actually the boros of the rainwater or the snow water or which is actually underneath and on the sides. There's two boros on either side of the mikveh. One's called a bor hashok and one's called a bor zaria. And there's one underneath according to some customs. And the way it works is that when the mikveh is in action, those plugs are pulled out and there's two apertures opening, connecting the water that a person is in to the mikveh, the real mikveh, which is outside, thereby making it one unit. So that's how it actually works. And those mikvahs are actually rainwater. And it has to be created in such a way that it never goes through a container. That's complicated because it cannot be, you cannot put it through the tap system. It's because in every tap system or any pipe system, you have elbows. Pipes are not a problem, but elbows are a problem because elbows are actually containers. So it's a very complex to be able to create a proper mikveh in the right way. And it has to be come directly from rainwater in a way that it isn't accumulated in a specific vessel. So the question really is this is not a kosher mikveh then, right? If this is true, if this was a container, it was like a bath, so to speak, then this is not a kosher mikveh. How does it work? So therefore the Mitzvah goes on further to quote the Yerushalmi who says, Amr Rabbeinu, he quotes Chazal who say in the Yerushalmi in Yuma, this was not considered drawn water. Ki raglei abakorim she'amdu tachtov hayu nekuvim v'chalolim v'derech bo hamayim min hamayan. In fact, the way they did it was that the pipe system went through the feet of the cows, right, so to speak, that it was actually just the end, it was attached to the ground in such a way that the pipe system went straight through the ground into the container itself. This was attached to the ground in such a way that it was not disqualified as a mikveh, which, by the way, is perhaps why the picture is inaccurate at the top of this page, because where does it have the water coming from? From the top. That's not correct. Right? So it would have to be that it was connected, says the Metzudos, from a spring beneath the ground, a subterranean spring, which there were many around the Har Abayis, in order to build for it to be a kosher mikveh to facilitate the Kohanim going and preparing for their service. Yes,
Dina.
Really? I would love to. So we need to take a class trip at Metz Hashem. Next week we will be going to see the Yam Shel Shlomo.
If anybody's going, it's worthwhile.
That's fantastic. I would love to see that. More complicated. The Kohen Gadol, so Heshi, you're referring to the Mishnayos and Yoma, are referring to the second Beis HaMikdash, where there was a mikvah on the top of a Beis Parva, which was one of the walls. That's referring to Beis HaMikdash Sheni, which was much bigger. This one, in the first Beis HaMikdash, was less of that, the extras. So this is where they all went. So I'm not sure in terms of in this, but you're putting out a very good point. It happens to be in the second Beis HaMikdash, there are more walls, there are more chambers, and there are more tops of chambers than the first Beis HaMikdash as well. So as a reference, yes, Esther. Yes, it was outside, right next to the Mizbeach. Yes, so it was not heated, if that's what you're asking us. So it was a regular mikveh, and that's what it served for. Now, just a few basic questions over here. That's what it's for, and this is where I get. This is my question that I was mentioned to Dina beforehand, and that is like, what does it represent? It seems a little uncomfortable. You know, it seems a little uncomfortable to be putting images of cattle in the Beis HaMikdash. What is going on over here? So there are a number of fascinating suggestions that are made. One is based on the Zohar, which is in the next source in 64. The Zohar says, Tochaze, come see. By the way, you will always notice that in the Babylonian Talmud, the way they draw you into a concept is Toshma, come in here. The way in the Yerushalmi and the Zohar is Tochaze, come see. Just a different sense in terms of drawing a person in. Tochaze, trace our shifting bedalad digirin. If it doesn't sound like Hebrew, it isn't. It's Aramaic. Okay, so there are 12 tribes under four flags, Bedalid Sitrin on the four sides. Shlosh aponim Sofona, Shlosh aponim Yoma, Shlosh aponim Negba, Shlosh aponim Mizracha, Vayom Aleihem. That this represents, in a certain sense, what is this, the model of? The encampment of the Bnei Yisrael in the desert. They had four camps made out of three tribes, and each on one of the directions. And this is definitely the way it is. They had three tribes on each side. So therefore, what ultimately he says is that this also reflects the 12 months of the year and the 12 Shvatim, and the Yam is Aleihem, and this basin is on top of them. Which in a certain sense, so if you're to say, what is going on over here? What is this Yam really doing? What is it reflecting? What metaphor is it? It's the metaphor for the unity of Bnei Yisrael, hearkening back to the time when they made the Mishkan, where the Mishkan was in the center. This is hearkening back. Why the image of the bull? There's a lot of discussion about this. One of the suggestions is that if it's reflecting the 12 tribes, then how did each of the tribes specifically contribute to the Mishkan in a way that represented and reflected their tribe? Was through their leaders. What were their leaders' names? They were called Nesiim, their princes. What did the Nesiim bring towards the Bay of the Mikdash? One of them was a cattle. That was the most expensive of the contributions, was this cow, and so therefore, so to speak, reflecting that initial consecration of the Mishkan in the same constellation of the way the tribes say encamped around it, there is this image of that unity of Klal Yisrael being reflected in the Yam. Now, you will say to yourself, but wait a second, but doesn't that have also dangerous ramifications? And the answer is yes, it does. And in fact, it was. Because that's why later on, when we're going to get later in Melachim, and not so far away from where we are now, once we finish basically making the Mikdash and the kingdom splits later on, in the rule of Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, we know that the person who splits the kingdom is man by the name of Yeravam ben Nevat. And when he splits the kingdom, he has a big problem in front of him. And that is that if the spiritual epicenter of the nation of Israel is in Jerusalem, which is in the southern kingdom, he's going to very soon lose control of his political control over the northern kingdom, because Eri is going to be going for their pilgrimages down south. So what does he do? Tanakh tells us later on an atrocious, a shocking act in Source 65, the king had advice in Source 65. He says, "Vayas shnei egle zohav." He made two golden calves. Vayomer alehim, Rav lochem ma'alois Yerushalayim, hinei elokecha Yisrael, elohecha Yisrael asher elucha meretz Mitzrayim. These are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. And you'd think to yourself, wait a second. If you were to say the top five lessons you learned from the five books of Moses, in the top five should be don't make golden calves, right? That was a bad choice. So why is Yerovam making a golden calf? Two calves. He's doubling it up. When we get there, we'll try to pry into that section in much more detail. But one point over here, which is worthwhile noting, is that what is he really doing? He's saying, I'm giving you an alternative to what Shlomo already created. Think about that. Shlomo already has the yam. He has the cattle. It's in the sanctuary. He's saying, you know what, I'll make an adjustment over here. We'll just do this. So what he's taking something which already seems as an icon familiar, and he's now reverting it to him, and of course now divorcing it from any meaning. But the point is still that the people, this is not as if he created the wheel. This is already in existence. Moreover, later on, fast forward a number of years, a number of centuries in Jewish history, where you have a very complicated king who's in the name of Ahaz. Ahaz has a very special son. Does anybody know who Ahaz was the father of? Good. Chizkiyahu HaMelech. So Chizkiyahu HaMelech, remember when it talks about Chizkiyahu HaMelech, when he buried his father on a mitah shel chavalim, on a rope bed. Right, that means to say he did not give his father the royal burial his father, so to speak, deserved. That's because Ahaz was a complex individual. One of the things that happened was he went north to Assyria, which was, in fact, the territorial empire at the time. And in order to curry favor, he felt that if he aligned himself, not just, we'll call it politically, but also religiously, he may stand more of a chance of the state, the fledgling state of Judea, to survive. And he brings back all this incredible stuff from their temples, and he actually replicates it in the Beis HaMikdash. Terrible stuff. Here's one of the things he does, and this is what happens in Source 66, and this is Melachim Beis Perek Tes Zayin. So what does it do? He cuts off the level stands. We're going to see about the mechonos in a moment. And he removed them from the basins from the stands. What did he do? He detached the yam shel Shlomo from the cows. Now think about that not just as a practical measure. Think about that as an ideological statement. What's he doing over here? This was one unit representing the unity of Klal Yisrael. This is representing what it used to be like in the Mishkan. And now suddenly the cows stand alone. That's a bad sign. Right? So therefore he is distorting the ideology of what Shlomo was trying to do for his own needs based on the Assyrian culture, which is what he's trying to adopt. That is the danger. Let's come back to Dina, to your point a moment ago. And that is that there is a danger which is incumbent in some of these symbols, although it does take a number of years for them to be manipulated and misappropriated. One last thing, and it looks like we're not going to get to this. This is a very famous idea, but it's just a very, very beautiful idea. So once you hear this, you'll never forget this in your life. It's such a brilliant idea. And that is that the mathematics don't add up. And that is that if you remember, we described, the Tanakh describes how that if you measure from one end of the bowl of the Yam Shel Shlomo, it was 10 amos across, diameter. And if you measure in the circumference, the radius is 10, and the radius is 30. So that circumference. So the problem is like this, is that generally speaking, there is no such bowl which could exist. Because the ratio, in fact, of circumference to diameter is pi, which is actually 3.14 dot, 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 because there's an irrational number, it never really ends. So that, what was that? There's a lot of dots. But the problem is that Tanakh never gave us any dots. And here's the issue. The way that Abarbanel says it, he's almost reflecting almost directly the language of the Rabbag, from whom we'll expect this to be said. He says in Source 67, V'hinei omru, shekav shloshim ama yisov v'asov soviv, hu al derech kiruv. It's an approximation. We're not talking about exact. The Tanakh is not trying to give us the tools to recreate the yam here. This is not an architectural blueprint. Ki koter ha'ekef be'igul, ena m'shlish v'diyuk. It's not exactly a third. K'moy sh'amru chazal, So he points out that Chazal were clearly aware of this. It's not as if, you know they had to work this out themselves. It doesn't, by the way, you can just do this with any circle you have. It's the same rule, right? So 1/7 of the is added to it. He says maybe an interesting, a humble suggestion. He says v'ulai haya midas akav asovev lekucha b'chalal hayam v'zeh yoser karov al emes. Maybe the description of the circumference was the inner circumference rather than the outer circumference, because remember how thick was the wall of this basin was one amma, which means we're talking about the inner circumference is a smaller circumference, which does match up, in fact, the outer diameter. That's the suggestion that he would have. However, there is a very famous idea which is attributed to the Vilna Gaon, who says, maybe we just got to give Tanakh a little more respect, right? So, you know, I understand that, yes, we kind of think of, you know, everything anachronistically, and, you know, we're so sophisticated, and we get it all, and they were kind of, that's not the way it works with when it comes to spiritual matters, and this is a spiritual matter, as well as being a mathematical matter. So if you take a look back to the Pasuk, in Pasuk Chof Gimel, which I put again here in 68, just to see it in actual words, it's actually fascinating. He says, Vayas is a Yamutzak. So he made the yam, this is the basin. It was 30 in circumference, 5 high. The kav, 30 ba'ama, yosov esosoviv, and it one line went around it. Now, you'll notice that the word kav over there has a parenthesis and an unvowed word next to it, which always reflects in the way it's the notation of the Mechon Mamre edition, which is the JPS 1985 edition that we're using right now for this. A 1917 edition of the Jewish Publication Society. What's the notation when you have a parenthesis? What does that mean? This is a kri uksiv, which means it was read one way and it was written the other way. The way we read it is the way it's vowelized in the parentheses, which is v'kav, and the way it is actually written in the Tanakh was with an extra hey, v'kavo. So you say tomato, tomato. In the end of the day, does it really make so much a difference? The answer is, says the Vilna Gaon, yes, the ratio makes a whole big difference. Because if you were to actually divide the gematria of kavo, which is 111, over the gematria of kav, missing that hay, which is 106, in fact, and you times that, you multiply that by 3, you'll get 3.141509, which is actually to the 10,000th place correct to pi. Which means we need to just be a little more careful when we make assertions and assumptions about what Tanakh knows or does not know. And that's specifically why it is talked about in the area of circumference. Meaning, if you take this ratio and you times it by, and you times 30 by it, that is exactly the correct measurement that you'll get. Tanakh is not going to be able to convey this information in words, but it's going to convey this to us numerically. Which means that when we ever read Torah, Nevi'im, Uksivim, there are multiple tracks of communication. There are linguistic tracks of communication. There are cantillation. There's the tune which is conveying things. There's numeric. It's almost as if you got. Do you remember Lahavdil? When you go to past those old, the TV shops, they used to have like these banks of TVs, right? And they'd all be showing different things on them, right? And so, and you could be seeing all these different things going on. So Lahavdil, there's multiple bandwidths over here which are being conveyed to us, and one of them is the numerical ideas which are being conveyed through some of the words as well, which is one of the fascinating applications of this. This is one of the ideas of Yam Shel Shlomo. What we did not get tonight was our third component, which is the Mechonos, which are these wagons which serve a different purpose. What we'll try to do instead is, it looks like we're going to stay one step behind each year. So next week actually gives us an opportunity of finishing up Perek Zayin. What lays ahead for us is understanding now one of the also more mysterious parts of it, which is the Shulchanos and the Menorois, which is the fact that there wasn't one menorah in the Beis Hamikdash. There were 11. And there wasn't 10 tables, there were 11 tables in the Beis Hamikdash. Very different to the Mishkan. Why is that? Why are all these wagons? What do these wagons do? And what are the images which are inscribed upon them? We'll see that next time in Mitzvah Shem. Have a fantastic night. Okay. Questions, thoughts, comments, folks?